This is Chuck Anderson. We have an interesting show for you today. Our guest is the granddaughter of slaves and has some really fascinating stories to tell of her youth and her race. She was born in Huron in 1910, attended Huron High School and Huron College, and finally wound up in the California School of Beauty Culture in Sioux Falls, majoring in cosmetology. Please let us welcome our guest, Hazel Mahone. Hazel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chuck. Very glad to be here.
Hazel has a beautiful voice. Hazel used to sing with the First United Methodist Church Choir for 40-some years. When did you start with the choir, Hazel?
Oh, I think in the late 40s, maybe, 45 or something like that, perhaps.
Who was the choir director then, do you remember?
Byrne Griffith. Uh-huh. All those years.
And you, when you went to high school, if I remember correctly, you were quite a singer. What happened?
Well, they asked me to participate in the music contest, of course, and I did, and won first locally, and then in Brookings at the district, and then Vermilion at the on the state level. Mm-hmm. And I tried to pursue a musical career for many, many years, and did some very fine singing in the Methodist Church and in our community.
And I can remember many years hearing you as a soloist, especially with the cantatas, which got very, very difficult.
Thank you. Very difficult.
Hazel, I've always wondered how we refer to the American Negro as such, and I wouldn't dream of referring to anything that is improper. Help me out on that now. How do I, have I got it right, American Negro?
Well, Chuck, I like to think of us as being American Negroes. A lot of people say Afro-Americans and Africans or blacks, but truthfully, I do not like the terminology black. We are American Negroes. We came over here as Africans, but we have absorbed the American culture. So that's what I like very, very much. And as far as blacks are concerned, there are very few black people, just like you're not white. You're kind of pink and rosy and tan and everything. And I'm not black. I'm kind of coffee cream color.
So I'm going to use the word American Negro, and I'll be correct, at least with you, right, Hazel?
Yes, that's fine.
Hazel,
fine.
Your grandmother worked as a... Now, we had two types of slaves, if I remember correctly. You had the ones that worked in the fields.
Right.
And what did the other ones do?
They were house slaves.
And as I understand it now, they were kind of chosen by the skin of their color where they would be at.
More or less, but many of them were house slaves because one parent was a member of, well, like a plantation owner. Could have been the owner, one of his sons. Now, my grandmother's father was a son of the plantation owner, and she was very fair, whiter than you. She was a house slave and also a brother. But in that family, where there were three other children who had a Negro for a father, so they were brown, dark brown skin. So this is what you got in many, many slave situations.
Wow. And you mentioned that sometimes their names would change as they were sold from one plantation owner to another?
Oh, very, very much so. Many slaves, they took the master's name, of course, and if you were sold two or three times, you had two or three names. That's why when they talk about tracing your roots, truthfully, few American Negroes have very deep roots, maybe second, third generation, but we cannot go back 8 or 10 generations and trace any roots. Look at the difficulty Alex Haley had, 12 years plus, trying to trace his ancestors.
And that was a fascinating movie. And I might add, I think, Hazel, that's really the first time I was really aware of the Negro heritage as it went back. It was a wonderful movie.
Oh, very, very much so. But do you know, both Negroes and whites were upset about many parts of that that book.
How come?
Because it told so many truths, and sometimes truths hurt, you know. But Chuck, I could never, and I never would blame you or your race for anything that you did to my people, and I don't think the whites should blame Negroes for some of the things that they're doing now. That's just a kind of an even Steven business. So it's just one of those things. But this was a very enlightening book and movie.
What name did your grandmother go by on your mother's side?
Oh, on my mother's side, my grandmother was a Shackelford, because those were the people that she lived with most of her life. She was not Soul like my grandfather, of course.
Was that right?
She was not Soul. She stayed within the household where she was practically born. You know, many slaves lived, and their masters were very kind to them. They practically loved them. But you know, really, some people do not realize the value that the slaves made the South wealthy, because they worked for nothing on a little clothing and food and shelter. Mm-hmm. And there, many of them were very fine craftsmen and knowledgeable people, because they built these wonderful plantations under the supervision of others. But they had talent. They really did. I think more field slaves were sold and traded off than house slaves. But you took the name, usually, of your master, and that's what happened.
It's just so hard for me, Hazel, to think of being bought and sold as a commodity, as like something at Kmart. I don't believe that I'll ever be able to have that kind of empathy. Can you remember any of the things that your grandmother or your grandfather would say about that? Was there deep resentment of being sold like a bale of cotton?
Well, I'm sure there was, and there was lots of hatred, because many families' children were snatched away from their parents. You saw this in Ruth. Lots of husbands and wives were separated. Yes. If the male man was big and strong and somebody wanted to buy him. And you know, they had bills of lading, bills, sale bills for every slave. On the record, you can go back and look at them. That's what Alex Haley traced. See, the slave, and even when they were brought over from Africa, they were listed. It had a number, not a name, but they just like cargo is recorded.
Mm-hmm.
They know what was on the ships that are being located now, and same with the slave.
Now, if I remember correctly, one of your ancestors was to be lashed. Given 100 lashes on a Monday. Now, if I remember the story correctly, they didn't give whippings on Sundays. That was, I guess, some sort of weird humor or something. I guess the Christian thing, we won't whip them. Yeah, let's not whip the slaves until Monday.
That's right.
But I tell you what, it's so fascinating. I don't want to interrupt you on that part. Let's take a break right now, Hazel. And this is Chuck Anderson. We're going to be back in just a moment. Visiting with Hazel Mahone. This is Chuck Anderson. Hazel, one of your relatives, can you remember which one that was, his name? What happened?
That was my grandfather, I think, that you were referring to, my mother's father. He was a slave, as you said, and they had accused him of not fulfilling a chore like watering the horses or something, and this happened to be on Sunday, and they said that they were going to whip him, but he had been beaten several times. But he made up his mind Sunday night that he was not going to ever be beaten again. So he prepared a little knapsack and sharpened some kind of tool. I can't remember what he said. And then he escaped into the woods. And as far as he could remember, he thought he was in the backwoods 30 days or more, working his way from the deep south. He was in the Mississippi one. And he reached the Union Barracks in St. Louis. And there he joined the Union Army.
A little ironic twist in the story.
Yeah. But this unit that he was in, the interesting thing about that, during the war exploits, they went back to the South, the very area where he met my grandmother, this house slave that we were talking about.
Yes.
Saw her on a porch, practically fell in love with her, and was determined that he was going back to get that lady. And he did, and there were three ex-slaves that were in the Union Army that went back to the South and married ladies and brought them up to Missouri, a little town between Kansas City and St. Louis called Boonville. And that's where they settled, cleared the woods, established their families. And from these three families, they produced 64 children.
Wow.
One had, I think, 24 or 5 children, and one 20. But my mother comes from a family of 16. And my grandfather was quite an interesting man, a little fellow, and very powerful, very determined, and could not read or write, but he established a little church for the black community in Boonville. And today there's a little creek that runs through there named after him. His name was Simpson, and that was named after him. He was an advisor, and as I said, he kind of set up a little store, supplies for people. And cemeteries named after him, the little chapel of the church. And Chuck, when I was there, my family and I, once we visited out there, we used to go as children to my grandmother, and they lived in this log cabin. And it was fun because it was an attic, but he was very, very strict when we would visit. He wanted us to get up at 6 o'clock and do chores, and he always called us nasty, stinking little varmints.
You had an interesting concept. We were visiting earlier today, and I said, well, so many times if something were to happen, I know the last thing that they wanted to do was involve the white justice. They didn't want to bring the sheriff in. They didn't want the police in. And there were also people who were sort of natural leaders. How would you become a natural leader in a American Negro community?
Well, I think if you were a strong person, and you know, a lot of American Negroes had no education, but they called it a mother wit, instinct or survival and protection for their families and their surrounding. So I think my grandfather was that type of person. My father was too. I mean, very kind, but knew what direction to go, and I think people looked up to them. And I don't think you could say they were selected, or just maybe they were named. You take care of this, Mr. Simpson, or something like that, because you kind of know what's right for us. And of course, being an honest person and integrity is so important. Not going back on your word. I think that's the only way you would do this, because they had no laws. There were no policemen. There were no sheriffs to go. If someone did a terrible thing, I think the community or the little circle would mete out the punishment. I don't know too much about it, but I would think so.
Several were sort of like asked to leave the community, weren't they?
Well, I'm sure so, because you know there's always a bad apple in
That's
each
right.
group, and I'm sure the communities like that wouldn't tolerate too much of that. You know, they'd put a stop to it earlier. But his life was very... And another interesting thing my grandfather always did, they had a well, I can see this right now, at the back of their house, and where they pumped the water. And whenever he would take a drink of water, he never would drink the entire, well, they had a bucket and pitcher. He always threw a little bit back on the ground and said, thank God for good water. You're putting something back that you took away.
Well, I've never heard that before.
No, well, it was they had lots of prayer in their homes. They had always an evening prayer. And on Sunday, it was almost going like going to church. At breakfast time, you sat and the scriptures were read, and he prayed, and my grandmother prayed, so we were. I mean, they had a strong religious ties in those families.
You were mentioning that so many things were kept away from the American Negro when they were slaves. For example, they really didn't want them to get educated, or they'd become a problem.
Right.
Except if they were house slaves. Then they wanted them to know how to read and write.
Yes, take directions. Uh-huh.
And they definitely never allowed them to have firearms.
Oh, never, never.
They really weren't allowed to have money, because they would become financially, possibly very powerful. But what I found interesting was they really didn't even want them to have a church. And where did they have to keep their churches?
Well, they kept them kind of in the back, and never large groups, of course. I think they would meet in maybe one cabin secretly in the back, and that's where some of our marvelous spirituals came from. Do you know, Chuck, that I think the only folk song, American folk song, is the American, is the Negro spiritual.
Yes.
Steal Away, Swing Low Sweet Chariot, and all of those came from slave cabins. They were talk to the Lord and all that, and in silent and muffled. So that's the way most of them gathered. And a lot of prayer, because they were praying constantly for deliverance from this, from bondage. You know, slavery is bondage.
Let us take a break right there, because that's interesting. You're almost on the Moses and the deliverance of the Jews from Egypt. We're going to take a break right now. We're visiting with Hazel Mahone. This is Personalities with Chuck Anderson. We're out in the backwoods. This is Chuck Anderson. I'm visiting with Hazel Mahone, the granddaughter of slaves from down south. Hazel, we're visiting about the American spiritual. Tell me about that.
Well, the American spiritual really is a contribution by the American Negro. And it came out of the feeling of oppression and bondage and what have you. And they made up many of these songs as they went along. Now, the few that could read and write, they had little excerpts and little knowledge of the Bible. They knew the story, the early beginning, the Genesis, and Moses liberating the people, the Israelites, from Egypt. So there's a go down, Moses, let my people go.
Yes,
and swing.
I could get some claves and we could really get going here, Hazel.
And of course, that one that many of them use is steal away in quiet, steal away to Jesus, and depending, leaning on it, the everlasting.
Sing a few measures of that, steal away.
Well, I don't sing well anymore, but you know that.
Come on.
Steal away, steal away, steal away to Jesus.
What a heritage. What a heritage. That's beautiful.
And of course, the rhythm, you must remember, the Negroes came from Africa, and the Africans had a rhythm about themselves, and a little of that flows into the spiritual, that inner movement. And it has to come from inside. It has to come from inside. Another thing that's very interesting, many Negroes name their children from biblical characters. There were many Marys. There were many Marthas. And the men, John, Peter, and James, and Moses, and Elijah,
right.
And all those, they stuck to that. Of course, they didn't know, they didn't read books, they couldn't pick a name out of some English literature or something like we do now. Those are the names that meant a great deal to them. So as I say, that visit that we were down there too, we visited this church that was named after my grandfather, and a thing that just really was mind-boggling. The altar was in the center, and on one side to the right was a picture of Christ, and on the left side was a picture of my grandfather. So the people really felt he meant a lot to the community. He really did.
How did your mother and your father get up to Huron?
Oh, well, my father came in 1901 as a mechanic with a thrashing rig, and they were working out around Cavour and Iroquois in the Pearl Creek area. And then he came back the second year, and he liked it so well that he stayed and worked for those people. Even in the winter, worked on their farm. And then my mother came in 1903, but her sister had been brought up here by a very wealthy family, the Camels, which built the house that Dona Brown lives in.
Oh, is that
right? That was a Camel. And they were one of the wealthiest families here. So my aunt was brought up as a maid for the house, and they needed more help, so she sent for my mother. And then she came. My mother, that family's from Missouri. My mother's people, where this, I'm telling you where Simpson was. And then she sent for a brother, Mr. Dave Simpson, who came. So there's this nucleus of three children that was established families and had children here, and we stuck pretty close together. My folks were married in 1905.
How did they get together? Now, your dad's out there in Pearl Creek.
Well, he would come to Huron, And oh, well, after that, he came to the Huron to work at the ice house during the winter. And I think that's mm-hmm. where, see, there were very few Negroes here in Huron. And the few, you know, it's just like any ethnic group. They're going to get together where there's a few. Oh, did you know there is a new Negro in town or a new family? Let's see who they are. Let's meet them. And, of course, that's how they met and were married. And, of course, the brother that came, he later sent for a girl that he had gone with in this Missouri area. And so she came up. So there's three families. But another interesting thing about our nucleus, I talked this three families, they were all pretty particular, and they had fair education, and for their children they wanted the best. We all went to grade school, high school here, and good education and lots of music. In my family, my father was gung-ho that we played instruments, saxophones, clarinets, we had drums. My sister was a very fine pianist, studied with Miss Gertrude Null for 8 years, almost a concert pianist. So we had a little orchestra in our family.
Wow.
We had kind of like a choir, and it was really a fun time. And all of this background helped a great deal when these few families in Huron later saw the need for a church for Negroes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the beginning of Bethel AME Church, which was just demolished a short time ago.
Yes, that was really too bad, Hazel.
Well, yes and no, but it had outlived its usefulness. You see, at one time there were many families, about 40, 45 members in that church. There were 16 children in the school system at one time. But as they grew up, graduated, they had to have work. They had to have some romance. It wasn't here. So they went to Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City, and those places to find work and mates for marriage. And they never returned.
It was better country.
I'm still here, though.
You were telling me now that the American Negro really did not like this cold weather up here.
Oh, no. A lot of people ask how many. They are amazed when you say South Dakota. When I've traveled a great deal. And where are you from? Oh, I'm from Huron, South Dakota. South Dakota? They still think Indians are running wild. Buffaloes, aren't they? And whatever took you out there? Well, that's a cold country, and they're not very many in the whole state. But as I said, lack of employment out here, and the weather is a deterring factor. And then, of course, many American Negroes, they like a kind of high life, a gayer time, and it's not here. If you live out here, it's like pioneering something. You've got to be a tough person to survive here, make your own entertainment, and be satisfied, be a creative person. And that is why you're able to stay here. I feel so. And I'm sure any pioneer would tell you that, whether they're black, white, blue, green, or what. It takes something.
Yes. Hazel, we're going to just take a little bit of break here. We're going to be back in one moment. Please stay tuned. Chuck Anderson with Personalities. Chuck Anderson, we're visiting with Hazel Mahone. Hazel, how did the Black Church get built here in Huron?
Well,
I'm sorry, I used that word. It was the wrong word.
That's all right.
The American Negro Church.
We understand.
I'm sorry.
Well, I use it once in a while. Well, when we were children, we attended the United Methodist Church, the one I go to now on 4th and Tansit. But as time went on, the nine families here in Huron felt a need for a church of their own. So I think it's about 1919 or 1920, the three or four of the older people got together and talked this thing over, and they were able to meet in the courthouse. Just prayer meetings. It started with a prayer meeting and a little service. No pastor or anything. And Sunday school, by all means, for the children. And then they thought, well, we needed a church. So, no one had any money. I mean, most of the people here had fair jobs to support their family. We weren't awful poor, but no one was rich. But how do you build a church? Well, I know many people here remember the famous chicken dinners that those people put on year after year, 2 a year, to raise funds for the building. Everybody tithed. I know I can remember when my mother would take her last 50 cents or a dollar and give to the church, because wow. she had that deep belief and faith
She'd
get it back next week. Maybe someone would call her to do a little linen or something like that. So, and then another thing with the musical background in that church, and my father was very instrumental in that, we were invited to places around the surrounding Huron, like Hitchcock and Cavour, Iroquois, Woonsocket, to sing for small churches. We were invited maybe to go for a meal, and then we'd put on a little concert, mostly spirituals, that they wanted to hear.
I wish I could have heard those.
And this was a wonderful experience for us and for those people, because many of them had never been close to Negroes. And the contact, it opened new areas of understanding. And some of those families became very, very good friends of our family. And that's the way they raised the funds to build Bethel AME Church.
Now, Bethel AME. Those initials stand for?
AME, African Methodist Episcopal.
Okay.
Because there are many, you know, the African something and Zion, and they took all kinds of names like. But this is, and the cornerstone, it was just taken out of that church. It was saved before it was demolished. It's down in a museum in Yankton. And another very interesting thing happened over there. Most of the blacks that came up to Huron in this area, they came out of the South, of course, but they had fair education. Some of them were teachers, not with big degrees, but they'd gone through maybe 8th or 9th grade. They taught in their schools, and then they had responsibilities even on the plantations because they were the smarts. So we had a springboard here in this community. We had a man that was very brilliant in debate and in programs and in organizations and protocol, and we learned a lot of things. We had tremendous, and we were expected and had to memorize many, many poems, and we had fantastic program. And as I said, all the families, most all of them had pianos. That was a must. You buy a piano for maybe $200, but you're 5 or 6 years paying for it, because you only paid dollar down and dollar a week or something like that. But there were musicians in every family, so we had good music in all these programs. But I can remember, and we had all kinds of socials, basket socials, and all kinds of things, anything to raise money to support that church. And then later we had ministers come, you know. Finally, a resident minister that stayed with us for quite some time. But it was a struggle. It was really a struggle.
Your mother was a teacher with only a 6th grade education.
Well,
isn't that
right? She taught off and on because she was the only available person with that much education to teach the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd grade. And that's what they had to use. And of course, there were no school boards. There were no, you know, and so whoever had a little bit of knowledge shared it.
There was a group of American Negroes out in Oneida area. We were visiting about that today.
Oh yes.
And
yes.
You said at that time they weren't even aware they were out there.
Oh no, they came. They must have come to that area in the late 1920s. After the terrible depression, they all came out of the sand hills of Nebraska, and there were about 60, maybe close to 100 of them, mm-hmm. and prominent families. And two of them were really smart, the Magruders and the Joiners. Now, part of those people, the Speeces, which some Huron people would remember, because they lived on the Brummel Ranch, and their sons and one daughter graduated from Brookings, and they really very, very intelligent people.
Now, how about the Days? I went to school. Mel Day moved here when I was in high school. Very, very popular kid. In fact, voted student body council.
That's right. State president,
yes.
Or something like that.
All-stater. Everything.
All-stater, that's right. Yes, very, very smart. Well, his family, they were, Mel Day, that's right, the Days and the Speeces. They're also intermarried. But you see, when they were grown, They had to leave. There was nothing here to keep them.
Sure.
Had we been able to keep, say, even 75% of the Negroes that were in this community at one time, we'd have had a dynamic community, maybe 600 or 800 or 1,000 Negroes. Mm-hmm. But as I told you before, it just wasn't possible to do it. But this church thrived until about 10, 12 years ago. And then, of course, all the older people died out. The younger ones were gone. And it just folded, as many of them. You're seeing much of this now in all denominations.
Yes.
And it just stood there and deteriorated until finally the city condemned it. But they have saved the cornerstone, which is in this museum in Yankton.
And which museum is
it? It's just starting, and there's a little church, and they're turning it into a black museum in Yankton, and they're trying to gather material from any black community that was in the Dakotas. So there will be, Sioux Falls will feed in a lot, and Yankton, and Mitchell, and Huron. And I don't know how much they'll get out of Pierre mm-hmm. in the Rapid City area, but they're doing well, lack of funds, of course.
Right.
And so it's difficult, but there will be something saved. We had some old pictures of the congregation that were turned over there, and I recognized most of those people in those days.
We're going to be back in just a minute, Hazel. Thank you. You're such a wonderful guest. I can see right now I'm not even going to get to a tenth of the questions that I wanted to ask you. We'll be right back. This is Personalities with Chuck Anderson. Chuck Anderson, we're visiting with Hazel Mahoan. Hazel, the museum that we were just visiting about before the end of that segment, is there some person that you'd like to mention on the air that if someone had something they'd like to contribute to this museum? Do you know of a person down there that they could contact to give to?
Well, the people that are really promoting this, they live in Sioux Falls, David Kemp and Alice Vaughn. And I can easily get the address, so if someone is vitally interested, they could contact me, and I'll give. And we do have a few brochures.
Okay.
So we're trying to get a display in the Centennial Church, two or three panels of what's going on.
That'd be a great
idea.
And
so hopefully they can bring that up sometime this summer, and there'll be some publicity about that, which should be good.
Tell me about your father.
Well, my father. We didn't know, he was a real fine man, but we didn't know too much about his background because he never talked too much about himself. But he did come out of Mississippi, and about 35 years later, a brother was the one that found my father, and they'd been separated for all those years. And he was in Sioux City, and of course my father was here. And this is quite an interesting story, how they got together, because they didn't believe, my father did not believe that someone knew him. I don't know, maybe he did something he shouldn't have and left between sons. He came up here anyway. No, we knew little of him, but he was a powerful man and certainly was gung-ho about his children getting a good education. You know, Chuck, in those days, my folks struggled and bought a library for us, a biblical library and also Encyclopedia Britannica. And that was something. It was a struggle to pay for it, but I can see these beautiful books, and they became, the pages were dog-eared because we were made to use them. And I think that's why we all love to read so much.
Your father, as I understand it, held a rather prestigious position was it the Chicago Northwestern Railroad?
Well,
where he had actually power over the other immigrants that came in?
Well, I don't know what I'd call it prestigious, but he did have, after two or three years with the ice company, he got a job with the Chicago Northwestern at the rail mill. He was the foreman of the rail mill. Now, what this meant, that they brought in the iron and they cut all the rail tiles, and this lasted about 10, 12, maybe 15 years. And they furnished the rails for the road from Huron to Pierre and from Huron to Brookings, all under my father's supervision. And during that time, they brought in Germans, Poles, Czechs, Chinese, blacks. At 40 and 50 people worked under his supervision.
So that was quite a prestigious and powerful position in those days.
Well, I suppose it was.
Yes, it was.
And then, of course, after the rails were laid, there wasn't an awful lot. He still had the job, I think, maybe 5 or 6 years, but there wasn't a lot. And I can remember his office and this and that. We took his lunch. My mother would send us, and we had a certain street that we went down. We lived in the east part of town, and that's the street we went down to carry his lunch day after day. Yes, he was.
How'd you meet your husband? He's a Chicago Northwestern.
Oh, well, I met him. He was a dining car inspector, and I met him one time when I was coming back from Chicago. And in fact,
Was it love at first sight?
Well, No. In fact, it wasn't my doings. My sister was coming home, and that was at a time when they were evicting people in Chicago when they had families, and she just had a new baby. And they told her, you cannot live in this apartment complex.
Why is that, Hazel?
Well, no children, see. No pets or children. Oh. No racial thing. Okay. And, of course, immediately, this little boy, he was only maybe, it wasn't 2 weeks old. And we happened to be in, so we said, well, come on home with us and tell your husband till Robert finds your apartment. So that was the agreement. So there's my mother and this my sister with this tiny baby and myself. And Bill was in the dining car. So they went in to eat. And then when I went in, we just visited. And then when my sister went home and came back again, he happened to be on the train, and he asked about me. So she told him. I had a letter, 2 or 3 letters, before I answered any. I just thought, well. But,
you
know.
Playing hard to get, Hazel?
No, not exactly. But I'd had a, you know, unpleasant. My first marriage didn't turn out. So, and I was very contented and happy in my business and contented with my music and my position in the community. So I wasn't searching for anything. My husband and I, we went together about 6.5, 7 years before we married.
You just didn't rush into it?
No. Because his work was Chicago line. I'm out here. So they're just, it worked out fine. Beautiful man.
Tell us about your business, Hazel. Tell our listeners how it all started. And we've got a minute or so.
Yes, okay.
We can get started onto the story, and we're going to just take a little bit more time in that next segment. We've got you down to Sioux Falls. You've finished the school on cosmetology. Then what happened?
Well, I came back here. See, I had been to Huron College for two years, and I thought I was going down to Blossom, Alabama to teach, but I found out through some knowledgeable people that it really wasn't for me. I knew nothing about the South. I would have been in a rural school. Most of my students would have been bigger than I and rougher than, and they advised me not to go down. That's why I chose cosmetology, thinking I could do that and then go back and get my degree. But I never did. Well, anyway, I worked for Mrs. Roselle for a couple of three years, and then her health failed.
Here in Huron.
Yes, here in Huron. Her health failed, but she thought an awful lot of me. And she taught me things that were not in books. How to handle people and the dignity that you, and, well, things that just aren't in books. Well, when she passed, they found a will, and she had left me her little shop. Now, this sounds wonderful, and it was, but there wasn't much there. But it was a springboard for me to start.
It was a start.
It was a start. And that's how I stayed. It was in the Masonic Temple. And I had nothing to start with, only makeshift. But the people that were in that building were very kind to me. A McClaskey and Dr. Horton and the Kewens and all people that had been there. And they said, go ahead, we'll go along with your program. And they did for a long time. And in about 6-8 months, my clientele built up. And before I left there, I had 6 operators at one time.
Wow.
Very, very fine. And and stayed in that business for about almost 48 years, cosmetology.
Years. Hazel, this is wonderful. We're only going to be gone for 1 minute. Then we're going to continue, and we're going to come back, because you're also a lady that has visited over 76 countries. I know that. So we're not talking to just some NEO person here.
Oh, come on, it's not that important.
This is Personalities with Chuck Anderson. Chuck Anderson, we're visiting with Hazel Mahone. What was it like to start a new business back in the early 30s, Hazel?
Well, it was tough, naturally, because it was the dirty 30s and no one had very much. But we had a small clientele, shampoos and sets and no permanent wave machine, but that came in and we were forced to buy one on credit, of course. But little by little, the clientele grew. But I built my business on $2.50 and $3 permanents. I wish I had been in business today. I'd been real rich. But of course, the cost of doing business was not so great then. But and you have to be careful. And it's not what you make; it's what you save, I think. And establishing a clientele that it's going to be lasting, not a fly by night. Chuck, to be truthful, I can almost count on one hand the times that I had ads in the paper. I didn't need to advertise. My business advertised my work. There, after a few years, you could not get an appointment with me unless you call me 2 weeks ahead. My girls would do it, but I was booked that solid. And nothing that I did. I will say this, though, being an American Negro, being any minority in the job world, I think you have to excel in whatever you do for any recognition. We have to be a little bit better for an opportunity. And then when they find out you can produce, you're fine. So the day, that's why I can understand a lot of our people, when I say our people, American Negroes, why they don't put forth greater efforts, because that's what it takes. You know, if you knew the background, many of them fill out resumes, but they can't. It's just like this token business. When the government said, you hire this many blacks and any, many of them were not qualified. And then if they were let out, they said discrimination, but they weren't really qualified. Now businesses, if they told the truth about it, they'd all, many of them have been through this. They had to disqualify people because they were not qualified. Mm. And then, of course, we holler, discriminating because of race, color, creed, or something like that. But it was fun to be in business, and I've loved it, and I have many wonderful friends today from my business days.
I'll bet you do,
yeah,
Hazel.
I really do.
Any advice for our modern-day business people who have come under the pressures of the economic times?
Well, I would just say if I were in business today, you have to cut back, you have to watch your inventory, you have to be extra nice to people and try to please. People are very particular now. They're fussier than they've ever been today because they want their money's worth. So you'd have to go overboard to please them. And I think this is the whole thing. I think that's the bottom line anyway. But you know, Chuck, the way merchandising is now, you go in store, there's no clerks to wait on you.
Yes.
Businesses, if you're a salesperson, if people didn't find what they wanted, it's up to you to find something to make them buy in a diplomatic way. And I don't see that today. Even when I go into the cities, the fine store, people are left to roam by themselves, find it the way. And I don't think it's good business, but of course, there's a big gap there, generation gap. So but that would be my advice.
When did Bill, your husband, retire, Hazel?
Bill retired in 1959.
Was he active then? Did he do anything after retirement?
Well, not anything concrete, but not in dollars and cents. But he joined a lot of things. He loved Kiwanis, and he got in our church, and he was very active in our church. He was assistant treasurer and financial secretary with Art Madison for, 10 or 15 years. Billy, you know, and he loved this community. He loved young people. Everybody liked him. He certainly was a gentleman.
Everybody
that's known my husband was proud of him.
You decided to travel. When did you make your first trip, you and Bill?
Our first trip was in 1964, and we went to Europe, 9 countries in Europe, and on to the Holy Land, which was a fascinating thing. And
wasn't all shot up then?
Well, the Holy Land, it was divided, of course, because of the British mandate. There was still a lot of trouble between the Palestinians and the Israelites and the Jewish people. And many places, there was the Mandelbaum Gates, you know, and the No Man's Land. There were soldiers on each side. You had to be careful. And if you went from an Arab country to Israel, you couldn't go direct. You had to go a roundabout way. But it was an interesting experience. And we were in both sectors of the Holy Land, the Arab and the Jewish. And I got a real wonderful picture of this thing that's going on. It's still going on. There is a hatred.
Yes, it's still there.
It's still there. But, you know, there's kind of a reason for it. When the Jews weren't there and had the promised land, when they were doing all their one, the Arab people sifted in there around the Mediterranean, and they're very wealthy. And when the British mandate came, 1949, that said that the Jewish people got all this rich land along the Mediterranean, and the Arabs were pushed into the arid. So naturally, there was a lot of animosity, which there is today.
Yes.
And of course, millions of dollars fed into the Jewish, into the Israelis, and so they could prosper. It is a land of milk and honey. Beautiful seacoast, beautiful everything. And so not only the U.S., but all the Western civilization. But I still think it's a touchy situation and have my doubts about how soon it'll ever be settled.
You liked Europe so well, you went back again. What, 1968?
Yeah, I went back in 1968.
Saw more countries, Spain.
Spain, Portugal, and then went into Morocco from there and into Africa.
Wow.
Africa. That was a time we had some students that that were here and some missionaries. And in Africa, my uncle was a missionary at Liberia for 28 years. So we made some contacts, and we visited there, and the people, the conference, it was a Methodist conference, made it possible for us to use the plane that went up into the hinterland, way up where very few people get, to see the work of the missionaries, which was quite an experience. And they rolled out the red carpet for us in Monrovia, Liberia, where my uncle was. A church is named after him there, and also he was one of the founders of West Africa College that's in Monrovia today. The first college for Africans was established in Monrovia by my uncle.
That's great.
It really was. So, but Bill and I, we had some real fine experiences, and we were traveling independent. By that I mean everything was arranged on this end, but our hotels, and we were met, so we got along real fine.
Hazel, I've just looked at the clock, and I absolutely can't believe that our whole program is up. Hazel, you know, I just had whole pages of questions to ask you.
Well, you can retape something for just you and me.
You've been a wonderful guest, and would you come back with us? I can get some more of my questions out, and you know I love you.
It's been a pleasure. It has been a pleasure to talk with you, someone that's interested in race and open-minded.
Thank you. You've been listening to Hazel Mahone, truly a remarkable lady of Huron, South Dakota. This is Chuck Anderson. I would like to thank each and every one of you for being with us tonight. We hope that we'll see you again next Sunday evening. So until then, have a great and successful week.